Welcome to Cockpit to Cal, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot, AMP, and IA, and president of Social Flight.
I'm Brian Schiff. I'm an aviation educator, a flight instructor, and on the side, I'm a captain for a major U.S. airline.
So, Brian, we have a lot to cover tonight, and I want to start with one quick thing, which is just a recap of where we are with the FAA's MOS interpretation, which is something we've talked about over the past couple shows. It's been a really, really big deal going on in general aviation, in all of aviation, actually, way beyond GA, about this this FAA interpretation that came out, which basically changed the way that supervision could be done. The way that the FAA interpretation came out originally said that supervision had to be done right there in person while overlooking the person you were supervising, which effectively had the power to grind to a halt the way that GAA maintenance is done. Because you generally have a lot of people that are either training or owners working on their aircraft or all sorts of other types of things in the facility. And you it's not one-to-one. You're not standing there looking over someone's shoulder the whole time. So you can look back for everybody on the show and see the history of that, maybe read some of the AOPA articles I've written on the subject. But this interpretation is currently has a stay on it. It is on hold. And that is thanks so much to the great work of so many people that I've been working very, very closely together with. Mike Bush, Pete Bunce, Jack Pelton over at EAA and his team, Mark Baker over at AOPA and his team. We've gotten some Rick Perry at AEA. A whole bunch of people have been getting together, putting a ton of pressure, I would say, is putting it kindly on the FAA to get them to listen, and at very least they have said we are going to hold and not enforce that at the moment.
I'm glad you point out the other groups too, because I hear several people have come up to me and say, yeah, Jeff Simon and Mike Bush have got them listening now. And I said, well, it's not just those two. They may be outspoken, but they are a part of a large group of industry who are talking about this. And I'm glad you mentioned the other groups who are responsible for bringing this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know what? If you go back to the story of it, which is there is an article on this, it's really, really cool to see and fascinating to me how this whole thing progressed. I would say that, you know, Mike and I took over the kind of distributing of action, like let's get things started, but we don't have the power to make change like that. The real change happened by reaching out and organizing the people who have all that power. And again, Pete Bunce at Gamma and all the folks that I've mentioned and many others that I have not mentioned by name, they're the ones who were able to really go and do that. And in fact, I even worked with Senator Graves, Sam Graves, who's on the House Transportation Committee, and his group to be able to get involved in his team. So a lot of other people did that. The FAA didn't listen to me, and they didn't listen directly to Mike. They listened to everybody else. But that's the good news. Now, the next part is stay tuned, because it is only a stay. It is only a pause. And then hopefully we will get them to reconsider the way all this is done.
Yeah. I mean, they don't do that for, I don't think, for one or two people reaching out and saying, hey, I don't like this or whatever reason. Obviously, a lot of people reached out. They reasonably explained the case, and the FAA is being reasonable enough to say, okay, we're going to take a look at this and see how is this really going to affect. And I'm glad that they did that as well. Now, like you said, how are they going to handle that? Where are we going to land forward? I initially responded to that with, yeah, I want a mechanic overseeing someone else working on my airplane. And I definitely want all for, as a pilot who's not a mechanic, I'm all for making it as safe as possible. And of course, in our previous podcast, where you discussed that and told me a little bit more about how that's really going to affect things. And in my experience, I've seen that I don't think that's really making a safer situation, but it's causing a bit of a problem.
Yeah. And so the next step is, as a group, all of the folks involved in this have asked the FAA for a meeting. And so we've asked them for a sit down where we can all get together and put all the data in front of them. And there's a lot of data coming from all the different groups in this. And that data, when I say the term data, it's not normally like we're looking at safety data, because it's important to point out this Moss interpretation, this ruling, did not come out of a safety concern in any way. This had nothing to do with aviation safety. This had to do with what is remote supervision, how can we implement that, and the ramification of how it was written caused trouble for all sorts of other areas. And so when I say data, it's been fascinating to see all these organizations reflect back to the FAA the FAA's own rules and regulations regarding supervision and regarding remote technology, because they use it today. The FAA uses it today. Companies that produce engines, especially jet engines for airlines and things like that, use it today. And so there's all this technology. Remote repair stations and other repair stations use remote technology today, and it's all approved by the FAA. And so we've basically, as a group, each individual organization's been putting together to the FAA its own case. Here's all the things you've done as an organization told us is okay. Can you please look at the precedent you set and extend that to maintenance facilities in a manner that preserves safety
So
and also preserves the supervision model?
what's your impression of what the primary concern of the FAA is, and do you see a compromise here? Do you see a solution to settle the problem that the FAA sees, and then also what industry sees? Do you see a middle ground?
I think we're going to get to a good place through education. I think that it's a little bit unfortunate, but my gut, by what we've seen in the initial interpretation and also by the reactions that we're getting from the FAA, is that this really is an internal communication and education issue. That we need the FAA is a very large organization. And this came directly out of AGC, which is where the FAA's lawyers were the rulemaking group. And they don't necessarily, they probably should, they had over 2 years to do this. But at the same time, I don't think that they knew all the pieces that we are, as a group of organizations, giving back to them. And when they then look at all of this, when you educate them about their own stuff and then look at, and they can see what's been approved in all these places, then they can see, oh, well, that was really well thought out how we implement that for repair stations. That was really well thought out how we implement that for, OEMs, for all these other things. And there's this great technology around it. So maybe we can take a step back, think about it in those terms, and come out with something that I think is a little more, has a little more care and time put into it, and
Yeah, and something
education.
that makes
I think that's
sense.
going to be the answer.
Yeah, and sensical, because I mean, there are a lot of airplanes need working on. There are a lot of mechanics, and there are a lot of pilots working, not pilots, I'm sorry, I'm used to saying pilots, a lot of people working their way up the ladder to become a mechanic. And they don't just instantly become a mechanic. So somewhere along the lines, they need some coaching and they need to be overseen. And of course, as a pilot, I not mechanic, I would not fly anything that I worked on, unless of course you were looking over my shoulder, or we have actually, you and me, used the phone and the Zoom or the FaceTime thing, where we're saying, hey, what do you think of this? And you've actually been able to help me, because laying eyes on it was very helpful. So I can see a world where that's absolutely gonna work.
I really want to take this kind of from a different perspective than I think many people have looked at this from. And what I mean by that is many people looked at the idea of using remote technology and saw it as a shortcut, saw it as some, if there are people who have voiced concerns over the quality of maintenance happening, and have said, oh, this is another shortcut. It's going to get worse. I look at that the other way around. I say we have more and more technology that's coming our way. It's the way we're doing this show right now, right? That we wouldn't have done 10 years ago. And so as the technology comes along, we have an opportunity as an industry to say, how can we apply this with a mandate and a goal of increasing reliability, increasing quality, increasing oversight, and how the skills are applied? I think you can go you can look at it a completely different way. For example, I just got back from NBAA, and what was fascinating being there is some of the companies, one company in particular I saw there, was doing remote supervision technology and remote assistance technology with a helmet, with not really a helmet, but a little piece that went over and had a little vision device that went over the mechanics
It's like the virtual
thing.
reality goggles or something.
Sort of, but like less to deal with, really just a little thing that comes down and makes it easy to do that. And so if we think about it less in terms of having the concerns people have of having someone unqualified working on their aircraft unsupervised, actually it's different. Actually, it's the idea we could take this technology and the way they use it in jets, airlines, stuff like that, is someone who's already trained and knows what they're doing and then sees something that they're not 100% sure of, can immediately dial up tech support at Continental, tech support at Lycoming, tech support at the OEM, someone else involved, and say, hey, look at this. Because it isn't just one way. There's a camera in that headset.
And
And if it lets
arguably
them
that's
see
more,
just what you're doing, that
yeah.
dramatically increases
So
your
arguably that
quality.
makes people more readily available if you think about it. And
Absolutely.
I think Elon Musk would agree with you. Also, we look at all the research that's being done into single pilot aircraft. We're getting there with pilots on the pilot end of it as well. We are not going to have two pilots in the front of an airliner, 20, 30 years from now. That's my opinion. We're going to have one pilot and probably a monitor on the ground. And eventually there may not even be a pilot up there. So, I mean, automation, you can fight it all you want, but technology and advancing and things and tools that we can use, we can't turn them down just because they're new.
Yeah, I think it's a carrot and a stick approach that we need to do. The
Yeah.
carrot is using technology as much as possible to make it easy to get the best information possible to people at the right time, so they're not just making rough judgment calls. They have really good guidance, getting experts in, but also making it possible in the mechanic shortage to leverage people that have lots of experience, are training to be mechanics or owners who want to work on their plane, and help get them supervised so we can multiply the workforce. That's the carrot. I think the stick side of things is to go back to the existing regulations and say, hey, you can do this. We're encouraging this. But when you do this, and just know that nothing has changed about your responsibilities as a certified A&P, that you are putting your license and on the line when you certify this is airworthy. So know that we're going to be watching that even more. Know that we're going to be encouraging aircraft owners that if substandard work or something like that occurs on an aircraft, the FISDO is going to be coming down hard. Why? How is it that if you could have supervised this in any number of ways, that this got done wrong? So carrot and stick together, I think, could take us really far.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's awesome. And you made reference to like some shops not being so good, or reference about some shops not being good, or measuring the quality of a shop. How does a pilot do that? How does a pilot, or an aircraft owner, I should say, bring you got a shop here. How do you measure, or industry-wide, are we really having a problem with shops? I mean, are we having airplanes break more, or is this, they just break sometimes, right?
Well, we don't have a reporting system for this that's other than when people take the time to actually turn someone in, like actually report to the FAA that there's an airworthiness concern. When they do that, of course, then it's tracked, then it's reported. But we're not catching everything that's happening out there. And I
No.
think that it tends to be a bit problematic because, like we know with restaurant reviews, with anything, it's not as many. The question is, how many people are picking up their aircraft and going, everything was just as it should be? We don't see that. We only see
Right.
the issues, and then you got to get to the bottom of it. So I want to turn the tables on you for a minute as we lead
Yeah.
into that, because
Yeah.
you sent me a picture just before we went on the air. Will you share that with everybody?
Well, yeah, I will. So this was, I know everybody's going to say, how was your landing? And the landing was a greaser. I went up today. It was the first, coincidentally, the first flight after the annual inspection. And taxiing back to the hangar, it just seemed to take a lot of right rudder, more than normal, and there was no wind. And I got out and looked at my two mains were fine, and there's the tail wheel. So obviously, it wasn't like that when I took off. And I don't think my landing did that, although I've certainly caused issues on landings. This one didn't. Yeah, so I actually texted you, I think, can I fly like this? Obviously, I had already been flying, and that was a joke. Obviously, you don't go fly like this. But how does this happen? Just a normal landing, and I'm taxiing in, and it needs all this rudder. And is this because of something that happened in the annual?
So that's a great question, because I love that this is the real life example, real world example of something here, because my question back to you with something like this before we start point thinking that, oh, maybe this is the shop, maybe this is the annual, is, okay, what was your pre-flight like? Did you check the pressure on your tire before you flew?
Of course I did, Jeff. With a tire gauge.
Okay, so we'll assume that.
No,
So
but let's say
if
I will
the
say this. I use a tail dragger to move my aircraft, and to put that on the tailwheel, the tailwheel has to be inflated. You can't get it on there with a flat tire. I tried to put it on here to get it back in the hangar, and I couldn't even get the thing on. So it obviously wasn't flat when I left, and it was went onto that tail dragger just fine. So when I took off, I believe I do look at my tires. I kick them like you're supposed to, and it felt like it hurts my toe. It's okay.
So I think if we're going to get good data, if we're going to narrow things down and really know when there's an issue with the shop, it's either going to be obvious or not. We need a baseline, and one of the things we need to do is aircraft. You know, I'm not just a mechanic, right? I'm an aircraft owner. I'm a pilot, and it's important that we do our part in all of this. A lot of people wind up, let me ask you this. Were you flying the aircraft a lot before you brought it into the annual?
No, in fact, it had been sitting for a while.
Okay.
Now,
So I encourage people, and I think we need more people to take this approach. Do try, make a real effort to do a decent amount of flying prior to bringing it into the annual. I know there's life gets in the way, but if you can try to make sure that you've flown it fairly regularly coming right into the annual, then a few things. First of all, you can figure out what the norms are. You can make sure that you know what's that everything's the way you're comfortable, it's normal. You can develop your squawk list of what things you believe as an aircraft owner need attention in the annual. And then the last step is, as you drop off the plane, you should do this with the mechanic, but if for some reason you just can't get your mechanic's time or whatever, do it yourself. You have to do a pre-annual inspection, your own
Wait,
pre-annual
wait, 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 wait.
inspection.
A pre-annual inspection?
Yes,
Okay,
absolutely.
I've never heard of this. So
So I'm
I'm all ears now, Jeff. What should I inspect before that? I mean, obviously I look for things that are wrong because I want my mechanic to fix these things. But what is a pre-annual inspection?
I was taught by Jim Casey down in Mansfield, Massachusetts, and I am indebted to him for really setting my standards of what you do when you take an aircraft into annual inspection. And he used to do a walk around of the aircraft before it comes in his shop, because he doesn't want to be blamed for a ding, a problem, something that wasn't working. He wants to. Oh, this fairing, look, you know your fairing's cracked. You know this other thing, you know everything. And I don't think he was doing that just to keep people from pointing fingers. I think it was just good practice.
Yeah, well,
And
last annual I did last year, I took a video. I always do a walk around video of the aircraft, just like when I return a rental car in good condition. I want to have a video proof that, hey, this thing was fine when I gave it back to you. Just like turning the airplane in for the annual, I take a video. And that actually helped me a couple annuals ago because it was a different shop. It came back with a bent rudder. And I'm like, it wasn't like that before. So,
there you go.
yeah,
So
obviously
I
very
would say
important.
do that. Do that very, very detailed. I mean, you can take pictures and things like that. I'm not really that concerned about that side of it. I'm really thinking, do a pre-flight at a level you don't normally do, which is, literally moving the plane, making sure everything's right. Look at leaks, look at making sure everything works. Check and everything you can imagine, moving control surfaces on the ground, et cetera, checking your tire pressures, going through all of it before it goes into annual. And then do run up. Go through and do run up, but don't just do a run up, write down everything. There's you we as a, what I do, and most shops should do themselves, should be a pre and post annual checklist that has a run
Yeah.
up of exactly what's your mag drop at idle up, what's your idle RPM,
I would
what's
like
your
to see a
full.
shop give me a checklist to say, hey, before you bring it in, I want you to do this checklist. I would love to see
Many
this
do,
checklist.
many do.
Really?
Very, I
And
was.
then I would like the mechanic to go around the airplane with me before and after the annual, because I mean, I just think I get a good debrief from my mechanic, which I think is awesome, really helpful. Hey, we found this, and you should look at this. And this is something we might look at future. We'll keep an eye on this, but it's okay for now, so on and so forth. But I think going in beforehand, I don't know everything to look at as a just a dumb old pilot. I think it would be fun to have and useful to have a mechanic walk around with me, both of us beforehand, and he could say, "Hey, is this something that's normal?" And I
I
could say, "Never seen it."
totally, I think it's really important. I think it should be done pre and post. 30 minutes, you're
Yeah,
going
I
to
like
pay for
it.
an extra hour of maintenance. Like, this is not for all the folks that say my mechanic doesn't have time for that. I
I
kind
would
of
pay
call
for it.
BS on that because you got to pay, you're paying for their time. They bill hourly.
Well,
So,
any mechanics watching this, I'd be happy to pay for that extra half hour or an hour to get that kind of attention.
well, 30 minutes before, 30
Yeah.
minutes after. That gives you your run up, your check, or whatever. And then if you need even a flight afterwards, you can do
Yeah.
a quick pattern thing within 30 minutes.
I want to
So
take the mechanic on a flight with me afterwards.
that's what I mean.
Yeah, I want him to go up with me. If he
That's what
won't
I'm
get in the
saying.
airplane, I ain't gonna fly
That's exactly what I'm
it.
saying. Yes. And so there's a checklist for all these things. You should see what exactly, as I mentioned, what are your mag drops, but other things that you don't think about. What's your full power? Static RPM, brakes locked, full throttle. What am I getting for RPM out of the propeller? If you do a quick pre-flight before, what's your propeller get up to? What's it maintain?
Isn't
Idle.
that on the type certificate data sheet, the static RPM that the aircraft should
Well,
develop? So,
there's minimums, yes.
yeah, so I do that. I actually do that, and I've taught students to do that. That let's do a full power static run up, see what we get here, and then while we're doing that, we talk about high altitude leaning and show, okay, here's how you get more power out of it, but here's the RPM you should get, and then we know what it is at sea level. We know that that's one of the checks we do at the initial part of the takeoff roll because it's practically static. And then when we're at a different higher density altitude, we can actually see the difference there and know that, okay, hey, I forgot to lean it. You know, so it'll call it out.
So I want to see all those things written down. Oil pressure, oil to normal oil pressure, normal oil temperatures. You have it all down there, a before and an after. If you do that, you've really voltage, by the way, another big one. What are you getting for voltage? Both at your idle RPM and or your 1,000 RPM, usually idle isn't that big, but when important because your alternator's not kicking in enough. But and then at full power. Write all that down because think about it. It totally changes the finger pointing, the safety level. You know you're where you started because it's normal to adjust magnetos. It's normal to clean spark plugs. It's normal to
Well,
change the oil. There's all
yeah.
these things that are going to change, and you need to make sure there was nothing that adversely affected what you were doing.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And as I'm sitting here listening to you talk about it, I know that there are a lot more things than we're going to list tonight that you're going to think of. I think you and I should make a pact to sit down and make this checklist together, write one, and with the right legal
I
disclaimers
already
on it.
have them.
Do you?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, well, I would love a copy of that. We should share it with all our viewers. Is that something we could pass out
Yeah, I'm
or?
sure we could figure something out for that.
All right, well, maybe I'll put a link to it in the email, the follow-up email for this podcast.
Sounds good.
Awesome. I'd love to see
Excellent.
that.
So, my point is if you do that, then you stand a better chance of making sure that you know whether something happened during the annual. Or whether it's just that your airplane sat for a while and the kind of knocking off the rust. Well, the knocking off of rust either happened by the shop or it happened by you after you
Yeah.
got it out of annual and decided, oh, I gotta knock the rust off the plane now. And then all these little things show up and you don't know who to point fingers at. And when you do that, then we can start getting down to where we're back to people's concerned about quality, the Moss interpretation, et cetera. Because if you do that and then you find that an aircraft that has been signed off to you as airworthy, and you
Yeah.
go and you find out, well, I just looked under my wings and the inspection cover's missing, or something else that could be, even more serious, you have a stern talk with that shop and you decide for yourself if they're listening and things are going to change, or you reach out to your FISDO.
Right. And I think I'm
Like that, but
also,
you've got to do whatever you've got to do to improve the industry.
I agree with that 100%. And I also think that I'm somewhat at fault. I saw a question pop up that what was the tire pressure? Was it checked at annual and all that? And I thought, well, yeah, it was checked at annual because he told me what it was and that the tires are all aired up to this. Your compression is that. I got a full debriefing. But then my bad, the airplane sat for a month and a half before I flew it since the annual. So am I blaming the annual? No. Lack of flight. These airplanes love to be flown. I mean, the more you exercise, these wheels are turning and things are receding and moving. And obviously, mechanical things seem to break more when they're at rest. Airplanes don't like to sit idle. I think the most mechanical issues I've ever seen are when airplanes sit for a long time. So I think a post-flight would have been good. That way, to not tie this to the annual, because I don't believe that's how it happened. I believe this may have a slow leak. Someone said something could have been pinched, and that could have been the case. I don't know. That's not something that was evident by looking at it,
No,
but
that you're talking about like a pinch tube. That's only going to happen if you're either installed wrong or you're dealing with something that's already low, low. But let's take that example for a second
okay.
because that's a perfect one. So if there's only two ways this can go. If the aircraft hadn't been flown regularly and you didn't have your own knowledge of there being a small leak, a slow leak, you're going to know that yourself if you're flying on a regular basis and you start, keep having to put a little air in the tire.
Well, I did have to put a little air in it a few months ago before I flew it. And as I think back, I'm like, should have made a mental note of that. Maybe I should log everything I do that. Because if I'm doing that every third flight or every 3 months, there's a leak.
It's good to know for you, right? It's not
Yeah.
a maintenance logging thing to just put air in, but it's important and you need
Yeah.
to know it. And so one of two ways that you, if this was based on a slow leak, which I suspect it was, then one of two ways. Either you bring it in and you're like, I've been having to add air to the tail wheel, or you don't really know about it. And now we need to make sure that the shop's doing their job. And
Yeah.
their job is if I'm working on a plane, I go and I check a tire and it's down, but not like by a tiny bit. Let's say you're supposed to be at 40, but you're at 25. They
Yeah.
should, you know, the, it, I think it's a mistake to go 25. Oh, psh, now it's back up at 40. Now the question is, get on the horn with the owner.
Yeah.
Is this
Okay.
normal? Have you checked it? When was it last at 40? Like if you haven't flown, if you haven't checked your, it's that kind of thing. If I call someone and they say, well, I haven't checked it for a year, then I'm like, okay, maybe it's really, really slow. I'll put
Yeah.
it in and then I'll check it when 2 days from now when I hand it back. But at the end of the day, you're certifying when it leaves the shop as a mechanic that's airworthy. And
Yeah.
so if you, this is that post check, right? If you go and hand it over. It's airworthy at that moment. Make sure that it has air at that moment. Now it's your responsibility as an owner, right? If it has a small leak, they didn't find it. You didn't report enough information for them to be aware of it. And now
Yeah.
you waited 2 weeks and you went and flew the plane without checking. That's
Yeah,
part of an
6 weeks.
owner's responsibility.
Yeah.
6 weeks.
Right. So, would a low, two things. One, someone posted that Goodyear reports that their tubes lose so many PSI a month. Is that something you've heard of?
Yeah, there's leak stop tires that do a lot less. It depends on the situation. A tail wheel is really small, so you're going to get more loss for a much smaller leak.
Makes sense.
And again, when once you get a low tire, things move, things slip, you things
And
like
so that was my
all
next
sorts of trouble.
question. That was my next question. Would a low PSI under pressure tire, would that cause this?
Yep.
Okay, that's likely what it was then.
Oh,
So
yeah.
maybe I should go around with a tire pressure checker and check before every flight. That's probably the part of the airplane that gets the most abuse, especially when I'm landing, are the landing gear. The airliners used to have little PSI, pressure gauges on the valve stems. And that was part of our pre-flight when we walked around, was to look at the pressure of each tire. And it was supposed to be 110 PSI of nitrogen or whatever they put in it. And they were finding that too many pilots were writing up that the tire pressure is too low. So they fixed that by removing the tire pressure gauge. And arguably, a tire that's too low, especially if you have four main landing wheels on two gear, that they're splitting the load by four. And now, if you have one of those that's underinflated, the one that's carrying the rest of the load on that side is going to get hot. And I can tell you from experience, it's going to get really hot. There was an African, a 707 in Africa that killed I think it was a charter flight years ago. I'm sure someone on here remembers it. But because of a wheel well fire, because of an underinflated tire and a pencil whipped logbook, the remaining landing gear had to do the rest of the work by carrying all the way to that airplane during the takeoff roll, overheated, wheels in the well, wheel well fire, boom. We
Yep.
burn through the hydraulics and a hot, big massive fire starts and kills everybody. Awful, absolutely awful, just because of an underinflated tire.
Yep. And we had one in Tampa, a fire caused by something similar. But
Really? Wow.
that but again, like you said, that's the best way to solve a problem is just to ignore it. I find that if you have problems with nav lights or something else, just like wear an IFR hood. That's the solution. That's the best thing that you can
Is
possibly
that
do.
putting like your head in the sand? I know my dog, if he's about to get his nails clipped, you're coming at him with the nail clippers. He looks away because if he doesn't see you, you're not there.
There you go.
Yeah. I have another question because I have a superior engine in my aircraft. This is all about Brian asking Jeff questions tonight, right? And so but I'm, like I said, I don't know the answers. I saw a Lycoming AD come out. I have a superior engine, which is a Lycoming engine in all intent and purposes. Does that AD apply to me?
Well, when you say superior engine, it like all manufactured by Superior with Superior parts and
Yes, yes.
then I don't believe that it does, but read the AD for the exact details. A lot of people have Superior cylinders, so I want to be very careful about language
Right.
and making sure all that. That's another big news thing that came out, and that is this Lycoming airworthiness directive that affects 16,000 plus engines. The issue here, which started as an emergency AD not that long ago, and now is this AD, is about bushings in the connecting rods that can that are basically not up to standard in some cases. And the good news is that there it's not an incredibly invasive airworthiness directive in terms of monitoring. What they're
Yeah.
basically saying is check your oil as you normally check your oil at all your oil changes and look for bronze particles. Look for gold colored, like flakes, chips, powdered material, sparkles, all the stuff we want to look for anyway. But if
Yeah.
you're noted
Okay.
now what's different is it used to be here's all our standard guidelines for metal in the filter. This is when you worry, this is when you don't worry, this is when you can keep looking. Now they're saying, look, we have a known issue with some connecting rod bushings. And in these cases, if you have one of these engines, of which many, many people do, these bushings and connecting rods setups were made over an 8 year, nine year period, I think, 8 or 9 year period.
Yeah.
It was 2009 to 2017. And they're saying, look, if you're subject to this, if you're in that range, then the minute you see any gold flakes, gold powder, gold whatever, you don't get to say, we just continue. You need to
I
now
see. Okay.
check the bushings, which involves removing the cylinder. And there's a terminating action, which is, whatever, half an hour of work, take all the cylinders off the aircraft, push out all the bushings, replace all the bushings, put it all back together.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm being facetious. It's more like 40, 50 hours or more of work, and then you don't have to worry about it at all.
So is there a provision for like let's say you replace that say connecting rods and bushings. You could be talking about the seventh Fetzer valve for all I know. I'm not a mechanic. So the connecting rod is the rod that goes to connects what to what?
That connects your crankshaft, right? The main crankshaft, your propellers, attached to your
To
crankshaft.
the cylinder.
So that attaches, that goes, you've got this connecting rod has a big end and a small end. The
Yeah.
big end goes on the connecting rod,
Okay.
I'm sorry, on the crankshaft, and goes
Yeah.
around like that. And then it goes out to the piston. It attaches to the piston at the small end. The piston has a pin, a steel pin that goes through that, attaches to the piston. And there's a bushing in that, which is made of this material that is bronze.
Okay.
And they are basically saying, We've got a problem with this. And it's interesting because Continental had a problem with it too, a different type of problem, and they have an airworthiness that's like looking for chunks. If pieces start to fall off of your connecting rod
And
bushing
so
or
if you
nose
have
cone.
one of these engines that apply and you find these metal, gold metal in your oil, or you're subject to this, what is that? Is that you're replacing all your connecting rods? Is that a tear? Is
Not,
that a
no, you don't actually have to replace all connector rods. The bushing is a piece that pushes into the connecting rod is steel. And it's got the wear surfaces are the bearings, right? Or bushings. And so you basically just, if it were me, as soon as I saw any of this material in there that had me looking at one cylinder, I'd say, I just want to be done with this.
So is
So
that at both ends of the rod, the connecting
no,
rod?
they're only worried about the connecting rod part that's at the piston. So it's at
Oh,
the,
that's easier, right? I mean, that sounds like it'd be a lot easier.
you know what? It's probably harder, but because the connecting rod is attached to the crankshaft with two bolts, and you just undo the bolts and it comes right off, and then it's just two
Oh,
halves.
okay.
Can this thing has to have a special tool and get pushed out, and then a new one has to get pushed into place. But at the end of the day, it's six of one, half a dozen the other. If you basically keep checking. If you see any of this, see something, say something to your mechanic, stop where you are, kind of like stop, drop, and roll. Stop, pull off all your cylinders, put in new known good bushings, and move forward. It's
Well,
this is not the end of the world.
I'm generally not one to point fingers or say, but we'll figure out why this happened. Let's just fix it. But why'd this happen? What happened with, was it a manufacturing thing that someone decided to go with different parts or a different material or get them from a different country? What happened here?
Yeah, it is a manufacturing issue. It's a parts quality issue. And sometimes you don't know parts quality issues, they don't show themselves for years.
So
And
does.
then you have to figure out, is it just this one I heard about? Is it two? How are people reporting this?
Is that the owner's nickel then to fix that, or is that if all these Lycomings are doing that, shouldn't Lycoming support them? Someone from Lycoming is going to call me and say, "What? Shut
Yeah.
up!"
Let's just say good luck with that. If it's not under
I get it.
warranty, I don't think that those are the case. I will say that when Continental had an issue recently, they did an absolutely fantastic job in warranty coverage. They went above and beyond with making tools available, paying for the work that needed to be done at a level that I think was very generous for the number of hours that needed to be done. And so I think they set the standard, and this is how we have to hold the industry
Well,
accountable.
I hope so. I think that doing the right thing will definitely pay dividends in the long run, and I hope Lycoming does that. And I hopefully this won't cause too many problems for people. But if you what if you replaced somewhere along the line, you replaced your connecting rods with superior ones because in some overhaul they needed to be replaced.
Well, everything should be tracked. So this goes to something else that I really recommend that everyone do. This is another kind of one of Jeff's pet projects. The first one is probably that list we talked about, the pre-annual inspection. This one, which is really, really one I believe in, is that every owner should make sure they have a list, their own like spreadsheet of every component they get a chance to write down a part number and a serial number of everything. If you walk into the shop to see how they're doing on your annual, walk around the plane, look at the alternator, write down what brand it is, what a part number it is, what serial number it is. There's a data tag right on it. Do the same thing for the starter, for your magnetos, at fuel pump, anything
You
you
had
can,
mentioned this
make it a game.
previously.
Yep.
I'd heard you mention that before, and I thought that is a great idea, and I didn't do it.
That's okay. Now,
I
during
wouldn't do
when
it.
work is done, like an engine overhaul, then usually all those parts are tracked with serial numbers, suppliers, dates of manufacture. Make sure you have all that. If you're getting that work done, ask for it so it's not just on file with the person do the overhaul, but get a copy of it so you have it. So if it's internal and out of sight, chances are they have it and that it's there. But get your own copy and then make it a game to get as much as you can of your own list so that when you see one of these things in the news, it's like, oh, this new AD just came out on this component or this magneto or this whatever, this starter. And then you go, huh, do, 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 do. And then you get to go, bingo, it's not me. Like, I'm
Right.
not part of it. And
Yeah.
it's done in 5 minutes. You know you're not part of it. And when you go into your annual inspection, you can even save yourself some time and money because you can go right in and say, by the way, I saw these ADs came out, and here is my serial number and part number of the one that's on my plane. And you can use that in your AD log, Mr. IA, when you go through, and it just makes everybody's life easier.
Yeah, okay. I think I'm going to try and make a point of doing that from this point on. I'm going to get out there and do it. So I've got my list of how I'm going to change my behavior now is I'm going to check my tire pressure. I mean, it's easy to do. It only takes a second. And then I'm going to start collecting the part numbers and everything for everything on my airplane. I love that idea. Spreadsheets, especially probably a sense of reward when you start filling in all those blanks. Awesome.
And I want to be fair to the manufacturers out there. I think it's really, really important because I have been on the inside, been on the other side of this. I've seen what
Yeah.
it's like to be in these companies. And on one hand, you produce a product and you warranty it, and you do everything you can within that warranty. And then you're also facing all these other challenges where you're not. It's not like you're some consumer manufacturing company where you're always like, where can I get this thing cheaper? Let me get rid of this supplier and get a new supplier. Supplier management's really difficult, and it's all through FAA guidelines and FAA management. It stinks, and it is a lot of overhead. So no one's intentionally out there shopping around to cheap suppliers. I'm telling you, it just doesn't
Yeah.
happen. What
Yeah.
happens is all of a sudden, the person you're relying on just says it can't make you any more of these. And you're like, oh my God, really? And you do your best to get an end of life buy. And then you're off there and you requalify a new one. And you do everything in your power to get it to work out. And sometimes something happens. And sometimes when it does, you don't know for five,
Yeah.
10 years. And sometimes it's not a catastrophic thing. And we look at that and it's like they're doing the best they can in a low volume environment.
Yeah, I guess that falls into the category of, you don't have the big picture of what's happening. They're not just going out there trying to penny pinch and increase their profits. I don't think that's 100% the goal, but I never thought of that aspect that, oh, all of a sudden you have a supplier that's, hey, sorry, we can't get you those, or, especially after
Happens all the
2020.
time.
Right.
Yeah,
Interesting.
it's t and when it does, let me tell you, as a company, when that happens, you go, oh God, what
Oh,
am I going to
I
do?
can imagine.
Yeah, because in some cases you look at it and you say, okay, A, I've got to find a new one, and then B, how many months is it going to take to get them approved and make all this work? And that could kill your whole business.
Yeah, I get that. I know for a while the Pratt & Whitney engines that we used on some of the airliners I flew were getting their fan blades from a different supplier because we couldn't get enough of them, and we had a big problem with those and had to go back and I saw that happen at my own company. Luckily, I'm not the one who has to get fan blades and do the purchasing of them, but obviously most people want to do the right thing, get it done, but we have challenges that need to be overcome for certain.
I think that they need to work on efficiency over at the major airlines, and I think that the captains and first officers like yourself do need to be the ones sourcing fan blades in their off time.
Yeah, you do not want that to
I want
happen.
to see that. I
Yeah,
found something on Alibaba. This looks
right.
like it'd work. What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. This is a great deal. I found a bunch of them. We get 10 of them for the price of one. No,
I
I
got three of
obviously.
I found three of them in one of the tents at the Air Venture like
Yeah, there's a big box of them there. This guy with the beard, he's there every year. He's got them. I know he does. No,
Exactly.
I want to stay in my lane. I'll fly the airplane and I rely on other people to do their job on maintaining the airplane and fixing it and stuff like that. We've got great mechanics all over the industry. And you. And
Ha!
I'm very thankful for the people who work on the airplanes, keep us flying. And every time I have a mechanic come out and fix something that I found, I always say, hey, I really appreciate you being here and it does a pilot good to, I think, at least appreciate when their mechanic gets them back in the air again, especially when we can't do it ourselves. So,
I think they definitely appreciate it. It is
yeah, hug a
not, it
mechanic
is a bit of
day.
a thankless job.
Yeah.
But I want to hit on one last thing, and then I want to talk about flying, man. We're in like through the show. We're not even talking about flying.
Right.
I get to you. I have one other thing that's been coming up a bunch lately that I just want to throw out there to everybody, and that is group ownership, clubs, partnerships. I'm seeing something that with a number of cases that have come through to me and people that I've talked to, that's maybe anecdotal, but I think it's a trend and it's a little bit concerning to me. And that is, as I've been looking at people's flights and their data and things and other things, one of the things I kept seeing was these very, very short time frames between when they first started their engine, which means the engine monitor starts running, and when they take off and you
Ooh, I don't
see
like
the
that.
RPM go up, right?
Yeah, I don't like that.
And so I started seeing this, and some of them were like 5 minutes, right? Think about that. 5 minutes. So 5 minutes goes by pretty quick, especially when I'm here talking to you. And 5 minutes from startup, I can tell you, engine's not warmed up, temps from looking at stuff. And I said, huh, I wonder if I should see some more. I looked for some more. I talked to Jake, my son, who's also an AMP, Wicca, he's been seeing it. Said, have you been seeing this cases or a lot of this stuff going on? And he goes, oh yeah. He goes, they're partnerships and group ownerships. I said, what?
What does that make him want to do a short taxi?
So I didn't know either. I asked him that and he said, they're charging themselves based on the tack time. And therefore, the way that they are ch have chosen to charge themselves leads them to sort of treat it like they don't own it, to sort of treat it like
Ooh.
a rental. They're trying to
Wow.
get their costs down and they're forgetting that they're the aircraft owner, that they're supposed to be caring for the plane.
Wow. I wonder if anybody else is seeing that at all. Put it in the chat if you are. We'll see that. We'll look at it later. I don't like that at all. And I mean, what I do is I reach around and I unscrew the tack, but I give myself plenty of warm-up time. I'm kidding. That was a joke. Don't no red, no letters. Yeah, I don't like that. In fact, today I took a friend up and I specifically said, oh, look, this is a post-annual flight, so it's going to be a little bit, I'm going to be very thorough in my pre-flight, although I didn't check the tire pressure. But we are going to let the engine run for a while. In fact, you told me something else a week or so ago that I want to pass on, but we're going to take our time and check everything. And I like that engine to have plenty of time to not only warm up, recharge the alternator a little bit from the engine start, prove itself to me, let the fuel lines prove themselves, let everything kind of work its way and settle down. And I can't come up with a mechanics reason for that, but my own pilot gut feel is let's let this thing prove itself for a while. When I give flight reviews, and I've done this to people in a club aircraft, and now I think I know why, when we taxi out, they want to do the run up during taxi out.
Yeah,
And I'm
that's
like,
exactly
no.
what it is.
Wow. And so I said, no, I want you looking out the window. I want one hand on the flight control, the other hand on the throttle, your feet on the brakes, and your eyes out the window. If it's an IFR flight, I will let you look down at the ball and the DG moving when you make your turn. But that's it. Get your eyes out the window, get to the run-up area, and we'll do everything over there while the airplane is stopped. I've seen too many people trying to do their run-up while they're taxiing, and I don't like it.
How do you do that even?
Ride the brakes.
Oh, that's good.
I've seen it happen, and I
I'm
brief
at
it. I debrief.
1700 and cycling my prop while I'm riding my brakes.
Yes,
Really?
yes, yeah. And during a flight review, I'm like, no, let's not do that. I don't want you doing that. And promise me, I'll give you this flight review if you promise me you're never going to do that again, even with me out of the airplane. I don't know if they really are or not, but I just don't like it. They're so primed. Why are we in a hurry taxiing out? Why are we in a hurry to get everything done and get in the air? I mean, because we want to get to the fun part, but what is the hurry? Well, you just explained one of the reasons, and I don't like it. I don't like financially based decisions when you're flying airplanes.
It is a very, very bad idea. I
So,
see
one more
it
tick of
in
the tack on a
planes.
club or partially owned partnership airplane means that you've got one more tenth of a percent of the overhaul and one more tenth of a percent of whatever
Well,
the expenses you have. Is that why they're doing it?
the way Jake explained it to me is that a number of these folks are billing themselves. So it's literally here's what you owe at the end of the month, and if they keep, half an over the period of time, it could be
Yeah.
half an hour or more or an hour. It's an extra $100 they saved or whatever, billing themselves. I had it recently when I was going to take off. I had already warmed up. I was but not run up. I was taxiing out, and then there was someone who was just pulling out of their like tow bar, pulling out of their spot.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay. I was really ready to get going. So I said on the radio, I'm gonna turn around, and they seemed to be taking a while before they started. And so when they got on the radio, I said, it was total dead calm wind. I said, I'll go take the other runway. And they said, no need, and they hopped in, started, went to the end, and took off.
Was that first flight of the day? I mean, would they maybe they
All I
flew?
saw was a tow bar out from a hangar or whatever it was, and like boom, they were gone. And I just looked at that and
Wow.
said, that run up and rotation, that was a test flight.
Yeah, no kidding.
You were
So
a test pilot.
I've often said, and people have heard it before, you guys probably have too, is that people who get into their airplanes, like you and I get into our cars, crash airplanes. Those are the ones crashing airplanes, the ones who get into their airplanes, like you and I get into our cars, just get in and go without any regard for letting it prove itself, pre-flighting it, wondering what's wrong. I mean, we don't do that in our cars, but there are people that get into an airplane the same way. And those are usually the ones that don't attend podcasts like this or webinars or try to go for increased continuing education. And they think they know it all. And I think we need to reach more people somehow and get them just listening to us. One thing that you said to me a week or so ago that kind of changed something I've been teaching for a long time now, and it has to do with, not changing fuel tanks before a takeoff. Some people, I've had some people write me and say, well, I like to change, let it run for a while, then do the run up on the other tank. That way I can really test both of them. And my response was, I want to know how long it takes my airplane to flame out if the valve is in the wrong place. And I mentioned to you that I teach that. Let's go out on a non-flight. We're not going to get in the air. We're going to put the fuel shutoff valve off. We're going to start the engine, go through our entire routine. No matter what happens, we are not going flying. Just want to see where the engine dies. Well, you had mentioned to me, tell me why that's not a valid check, because I think your explanation, you didn't give me the whole thing, but I'm not going to do that anymore.
Well, it's not a valid check if you're talking about switching it to off, if that's what you mean as your
I
check.
was so that we could see how long the engine will run. Like, will it run through the whole run-up process and get me in the air and then fail? Or is it going to fail 5 minutes, 2 minutes after I start it?
So think about that. If you go and you, first of all, your valve is not at the tank, right? Your valve is actually is pretty close to where it feeds the engine. So, if you're talking about whatever, let's say you've got an 8 foot length, your valve is maybe 3 feet up in the engine. So, first of all, you've really cut that distance down. Second of all, you're stopping it and you are introducing a vacuum immediately. The minute you draw anything, you're drawing fuel pressure down, down, down. And so you're gonna starve it out even while there's fuel in it. It's not like air is gonna replace it directly in there. And
Well, that makes
so
a lot of sense because when I did that in a 172, we didn't even get out of the chocks, basically,
right.
the blocks. We started the engine, got the ATIS call for taxi, and by the time we added power to start taxiing, the engine quit.
Right. So
Now,
let's talk about what really kills people, right? What that's what we care about. And what kills people is water that all of a sudden that was in the tank, contaminants of some other kind, wrong fuel type. I know Phillips 66, who was a big, a sponsor of Social Flight, promotes a lot about using the right fuel and verify, verify, verify fuel type. All these different things are what lend it fuel blockage, a vent that's blocked. All these things take time to develop. It's got to get all the way from there. Something's got to get from the tank all the way through. To me, the safest thing you can do is give as much time as possible before a critical phase of flight to run it, run it, run it. Like find out that you've got something from the moment you've started through a thorough warm up, through a thorough, pre-flight engine run up. At that point, you're in your best position to know that that engine is most likely to going to continue to operate properly through that critical phase until you've reached altitude.
Do you
And then
check
at
both
that
sides
point, if you
in low
switch,
wing?
what's that?
You check both sides? You'd switch tanks while during taxi out at all?
Not always in that. I mean, of course, I pre-flight that, but no, I don't have a routine myself of doing that because you'd
Yeah.
have to give enough time to do the same thing on the other side. And so, do I think it's wrong to do that? No, if you're going to give enough time, I think it's probably better to go and check both tanks that way. But I also think it's okay to do proper tank sumping, all the other stuff you're going to do, and then say, this is my takeoff tank, and
Yeah.
have proven that tank
Well, and that's why I was
all the
trying to
way
say,
up to
okay,
altitude. I say all the
how
way up
long
to
is it?
altitude. Like, I wouldn't switch that at 1,000 feet, like all
No,
the
of
way up.
course not.
And
Yeah,
then, and even then, when I switch tanks in flight, I consider that a very, very high risk point. I
yes.
announce it to the passengers, anyone with me. I announce this is what I'm doing. I make the switch, and then I look at that fuel pressure. And I'm watching that needle to see what happens because it's going to tell me before the engine is that I've got a
Yeah.
problem and I'm ready to switch back.
Do you look for a place to land in case you do lose the
Absolutely.
engine or that? So
Absolutely.
I always just assume I'm going to have an engine failure every time I switch tanks.
Yep.
I find a place to land. I put the fuel pump on and I'm ready for it. I'm ready to switch it back if I have to.
Yeah.
But I do the same thing you do. And certainly it's going to be at a safe altitude. I don't care if I run one tank down a little bit more to get to that point.
We're the John Denver generation, right?
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
that's,
Ouch.
I'm not kidding. Like, that was
Yeah.
burned into all of us that we lost
Yeah.
someone that we grew up on because of changing fuel tanks.
Yeah.
And I think that we are what we experience in our lives. And that was one of those things that's
Right.
like, you know, we didn't have to think about it when I said that, right?
No. No, exactly. So I agree with you on that. But I will change my way of not really proving anything, and it explains why the engine flamed out so soon after closing the fuel valve, the shutoff valve. And on that note, I would like to encourage everybody to always know step one of an engine fire checklist, because you want to shut off the fuel, but where? Where's the closest place? Some airplanes, it's the mixture, some it's the fuel shutoff. Know your airplane. Always know step one of an engine fire. Just everybody go look that up before you go flying. So I do agree with that. I don't think group owners, I have not experienced that. I think that's something I'm going to watch for. Certainly, I'd like to encourage everybody not to put the dollar into your decision making, because that's usually where we make bad decisions. And I don't like to see that. One other thing I just wanted to mention, and we'll talk more about it next month, is that the FAA has been busy, very busy. And there are a lot of changes coming in December. So next month, well, we'll try and talk about what changes just took place, but for a lot of them affect flight instructors. If you're a member of NAFI or not, you can watch. We're going to have a mentor live that's going to NAFI will have a mentor live to discuss all the new changes that apply to flight instructors. But they also changed another kind of fixed, I think, an interpret a lot of interpretation on what a passenger is. So now we've kind of redefined that. It's kind of annoying the way it reads, but the bottom line is, when a pilot, an instructor, and a student are not night current, they could go up together when neither one of them is night current because there are no passengers on board. There's a instructor and a student and not a passenger. Well, they fixed that. The spirit of the rule is that if you haven't flown at night in a long time, go by yourself and do some takeoffs and landings. But we'll talk more about that later. A lot of changes to the FARs coming down in December. CFI renewals, some flight instructor ones, but also some that affect pilots in Part 61.
Very much looking forward to that. That'll be
Yeah.
a lot of good information for all of us to learn.
Definitely, definitely. I can't believe an hour has flown by already.
No kidding. Well, thank you to everyone for joining us this evening. I definitely appreciate it, and you know, we love you guys. We love the fact that we're able to get together in this show and share this. Keep sending your comments and your questions and all of your feedback, and we'll do our best to continue to support all of you. We are back on December 10th, Tuesday, December 10th, with another Cockpit to Cowl show at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, as always. And make sure that you're also subscribed to Social Flight Live. That's just at socialflightlive.com, one word. We are here next Tuesday at 8 p.m. That's Tuesday, November 19th, with Fire Boss pilot Chris
Ooh.
Ashleman. If you don't know the Fire Boss, it is a whip air equipped aircraft that scoops water up and dumps it on fires from an air tractor platform. It is so cool.
That
And
is cool. I can't wait to watch that one.
oh, he is cool, and that is a job and a half. And so he'll be here on next Tuesday. On Tuesday, November 26, we have John Nordstrom, who is your dad, Barry Schiff, connected me with him, who's coming on the show of Nordstrom, the chain of stores that we all know, Nordstrom. And he is an epic pilot.
And a great man from whom I've learned a lot about life just talking to. He's got some absolutely wonderful things to say. Like Bob Hoover, I could listen to him talk for a long time.
Oh, I am looking forward to that show. And then really, when you look at all these shows coming up, another one I want to mention I'm very, very excited for is Tuesday, December 3rd. General Lloyd, he goes Fig Newton, is it Fig is his nickname? General Lloyd Newton, a retired United States Air Force four-star general. He was commander of the Air Training Division in the United States Air Force. He was also the first African American pilot to fly with the Thunderbirds, to be a Thunderbirds pilot in an F-4 Phantom.
Oh,
Oh my
wow.
goodness, would I love to see that!
That's cool.
So lots of cool things. And again, Tuesday, December 10th, we're back with Cockpit Decal. So, Brian, thank you as always. I look forward to every one of these
And thank
shows
you.
coming
I learn
in.
a lot from talking to you every time I talk to you. We're going to try and apply a lot of that to a new program I've got coming up. You'll see some more coming out about it next January called The Shift Show. A lot of the stuff that I do usually turns out to be a shift show, but this one we're going to call it The Shift Show. Watch for some great content in that. It'll be an aviation education variety show. We're going to do it on Thursdays, so we're not going to interfere with Tuesday nights, I promise you.
All right. All right. To everybody else who's joined us this evening, thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you all blue skies. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.